Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are Nancy, Superfly, and Incredibles 2. I will spare you the sentence. Hello, David.
Okay, yeah, I know you love to make sentences out of titles. This week would be a tough choice. Chore. Three very, very different films, though the second two have something in common, because Superfly is a remake and Incredibles 2 is a sequel. But Nancy, the first film I'd like to talk about briefly, is definitely an original. It's a very small American independent movie written and directed by Christina Choi, and it stars Andrea Riseborough. And she plays a very, very small, little, humanly scaled, independent drama. Andrea Riseborough plays our title character, whose name is Nancy, and she is a young woman, and she obviously has, as they say nowadays, issues. She's a troubled young woman. She lives with her mother, who is a kind of a grumpy, sick old lady. They do not get along at all. Nancy, she clearly is not very contented in the world. We see her try to socialize a little bit. She goes on a date with a guy who she meets online, played by John Leguizamo, an actor who I usually don't think is very good, but he's very good in this very small role in this film. And that doesn't go very well. And it turns out that she's been making up this whole story online and convincing him that he is helping her get through an unwanted pregnancy and this and that. It's all totally not true. And then that sort of fades away. Then her mother dies. And around this point of the movie, which is still pretty early, she sees something on the news about a couple, a middle-aged couple whose daughter disappeared decades earlier. And ever since, they have been searching for their daughter and hoping that someday they would find their daughter. And now they're starting a scholarship fund to mark the anniversary of their daughter's disappearance. And suddenly Nancy apparently gets this idea that she might be that missing daughter of these people, that maybe she was kidnapped by that woman who was her mother 25 years ago when she was a little kid, and that she's actually the daughter of this couple who are now still thinking 25 years later of the daughter they lost all those years ago. And so she takes action. She gets in touch with these people, and she goes and she stays with them. They are desperately hoping that maybe she is the daughter who they lost all those years ago, but they know that she might not be, and they had a false alarm like this once before. So that's the setup for the movie. And what we have is this very interesting main character, this troubled young woman who is embarked on. It's very hard for us to tell whether she honestly thinks she might be the missing daughter of these people. Apparently, on some level, she does think that, or whether this is just another of her attempts to somehow connect with the world, to somehow have a life which is better than the life which she lived with her horrible mother, who is now dead. The middle-aged couple, who she goes and stays with for a while, and that is the bulk of the movie, are played by the marvelous Steve Buscemi, who has just become such a wonderful, mature actor, terrific performance by this terrific actor, and Ann Dowd plays the woman. That's the movie. Again, it's a very, very small, humanly scaled drama. Go see it if you want to see something that's an alternative to the sort of blockbusters I'm going to be talking about in a moment. It's a very, very nice little movie, and I just hope it doesn't disappear in the shuffle. And I absolutely think that Christina Cho is a talent to be watched. Let us now turn from the tiny to the overblown to Superfly. Superfly is, of course, a remake of the, can we call it a classic? The movie that came out in 1972. Back then, Superfly was a two-word title, Superfly. And it starred Ron O'Neill as a dope dealer. And by today's standards, that original, way back in 1972, could almost be called a sort of a pro-drug movie. Superfly was an anti-hero, but he was a pretty heroic guy as he went about his business dealing his drugs and then preparing for one, this is such a classic scenario, preparing for that one last big score, after which he could retire and go legit and live the life of luxury for the rest of his days. So that was the 1972 version, and it is memorable primarily for a sensational music score by Curtis Mayfield. So we now have a remake of it. All these years later, you do the math, 1972 to 2018, the title now becomes one word, Superfly, sometimes spelled with an uppercase F, but still one word now, and it stars Trevor Jackson as our main character, who, as before, his name is Priest, and as before, he is a drug dealer. And I can't say that even though we live in this age right now of real opprobrium being leveled against the world of drugs on every possible level, I can't really say that this movie is an anti-drug movie. It may not be quite as heroic a portrait or sort of glamorized portrait of a dope dealer as the original was, but it still gives him all the good lines, or most of them anyway, and he's still a pretty heroic character, and the basic setup is still the same. He is looking to make his last one big score, and for that he needs the help of his sort of mentor and sort of senior drug dealer, a guy named Scattershot, or just Scatter. And of course he's being chased by the cops, in this case particularly a female police officer named Detective Mason, and she also has a very, very nasty partner. And so we have what's basically a kind of an action movie. Now a big difference is that when the original Superfly came out in 1972, it was an entry in what was then known as, and is still known as, the blaxploitation craze. These were flat-out exploitation movies. Sex and violence and drugs and all kinds of nasty stuff with African-American casts. One of the interesting things about the great blaxploitation wave of the 1970s is that most, not all, but most of those movies were made by white filmmakers, with, however, African Americans primarily in the casts of these various movies. Things have changed a little bit, and now the new Superfly was directed by a guy who calls himself Director X, and this is largely an African American production behind the camera as well as in front of the camera, but it is no longer part of a wave of films that we could call blaxploitation. It is, however, I think, a part of Hollywood's very recent and very belated attempt to sort of correct the racial imbalance that has prevailed in the studios throughout Hollywood history. As I have said more than once before, probably here and definitely elsewhere, the movies as a global enterprise have from their very beginnings through this present moment been dominated almost entirely by white men. And there have been exceptions to that, but lately we have been having, at least in America, a certain reaction against that. And there's been all kinds of big publicity stuff about studios attempting to make their casts more diverse and to not have there just be a token black character who's usually the first one to get killed, and to have more than maybe just one or two superstars like Denzel Washington and so forth. So Superfly is a part of this wave now. I would say it's an odd sort of a choice of project in certain respects, because it does not exactly portray the African American community of America in an enormously positive light. The main character is, after all, a dope dealer who is trying to set up his last big dope score. But at least it does fill the screen with African American characters. And I have to say, just as Wonder Woman was trying to do this for gender, and the recent Black Panther is trying to do this for race, Superfly is very much trying to do this for race, but no longer in a superhero context, something a little bit closer to the real world that we actually live in. So as a production, I found Superfly perfectly watchable. It's incredibly violent. It's incredibly nasty in all sorts of ways, but it has a couple of interesting characters. Priest is an interesting character, again, played very sort of glamorously and smoothly and slickly by Trevor Jackson. I will also mention the marvelous Michael Kenneth Williams. I, of course, first got to know his work from The Wire, where he played the incredibly evil Omar, and I always have enjoyed seeing him ever since, and he is very, very good as Scatter. It's a secondary role, but a very important one. And I got to really, really mention Jennifer Morrison, who plays that very, very vicious female police officer, Detective Mason. She's really marvelous, and every time she's on screen, she sort of steals the scene from everybody else. So it's a perfectly good movie. If you like this sort of thing, by all means, go see it. Again, it's odd to see a movie with such a sort of an accepting vision of drug crime. It doesn't accept it, and it's, oh yes, these people are bad, but it's very glamorous in its own way. That's sort of odd in this day and age, but hey, I'm always interested in movies that are mischievous and go against the grain, and Superfly certainly does that in at least a few respects, even though for the most part, it's a pretty formulaic action movie that, except for all kinds of sort of modernistic gewgaws around the edges, is pretty much like the old blaxploitation movie from the early 70s. So now let us turn to our final and most celebrated movie of the moment, Incredibles 2. This is a sequel to The Incredibles, which came out way back in 2004. And at least at the theater where I saw Incredibles 2, they started things off with a little sort of a live-action little quickie where a number of characters, the actual people who play these characters, people like Craig T. Nelson, who is this is an animation, of course, who is the voice of Mr. Incredible, and Holly Hunter, who is the voice of Elastigirl, and Samuel L. Jackson, who is the voice of Frozone, where they all sort of appear in their own selves and say, hey, we know it's been a long time since the original, way back in 2004. Sorry we made you wait so long for the sequel, but here it is. We hope you like it. And then after that, there was a little short, very adorable little 3D animated short. I saw Incredibles 2 in 3D from the Disney people. And then finally you get to the actual movie Incredibles 2. So, the original The Incredibles was absolutely one of the best Pixar animations, or one of the best animations, period, in modern times. Very, very fine movie. It deals with a time in which superheroes, such as Mr. Incredible, whose power is enormous strength, and his wife, Elastigirl, whose power is that she can stretch her body into any shape and elongate it and so forth, and their daughter, Violet, who can go invisible, and the character I mentioned before, Frozone, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who he does freezing. He makes ice appear wherever he wants. All these people are superheroes, but superheroes have caused some trouble in the course of solving all of the, helping to fight crime and all that. They've caused some collateral damage, and they've been made illegal. And so in the original Incredibles 2, we have this period where the superheroes have to go underground and have to try to not exercise their powers or use their powers or help the world. Mr. Incredible, for example, goes to work for an insurance agency. And that's sort of the setup for the movie. And then, of course, they have to come out of hiding and do some secret things and all of that. So Incredibles 2 follows a very similar sort of a scenario. Once again, the characters, by the way, are the same ages. And Incredibles 2 begins exactly where The Incredibles back in 2004 left off. They are illegal, and they have to do everything underground. And this time, a sort of a really smooth-talking public relations operative. He's more than a public relations operative. He's sort of the head of one of these multi-jillion-dollar foundations kind of a thing. Gets in touch, and he wants to help them all get legitimate again. And so he enlists the Incredibles family, that is Mr. Incredible and Elastigirl and their kids, in this campaign where he is going to send only Elastigirl out on this great crime-fighting mission, and she will solve things so successfully, and with his new PR campaign, including body cams in their superhero suits, that everybody will once again recognize how wonderful superheroes are, and they'll all be legal again, and they'll all be able to do their wonderful work helping to save the world. But again, he wants to do this at first only with Elastigirl. So that means that poor Mr. Incredible has to stay home and look after the kids who have their own powers and present their own troubles to him. But one is an adolescent. One is a little boy, one is a baby who turns out to have astonishing powers and absolutely no conception of how to use them or even what they are. So he's got to stay home and look after these troublesome kids while Elastigirl goes out in the world, and there's a certain amount of family tension over that. Also, it turns out that big PR guy, whose name is Winston Deaver, voiced by Bob Odenkirk, he has a sister who turns out to be the bad person of the movie, named Evelyn, voiced by Catherine Keener. And there's a whole lot of stuff also about a character who hypnotizes people by using screens, computer screens, little goggle screens, things like that. And his name is Screenslaver. Now, there's been a certain amount of controversy over Incredibles 2, as over the original Incredibles, as to whether there's a dubious sort of politics built into all this. Why is it that there are characters who actually want to create human inventions who are the bad people of these movies, and we're all supposed to see them as bad, we're supposed to see the natural-born heroes, like the superheroes, as good? Why is that? Is there a sort of an Ayn Rand subtext to all of this, that there are simply people who are better than other people, and we ought to let them help us all and not get in their way? I can see a certain point to this political argument, and some very estimable critics are sort of taking a hold of it, but it really can't, it doesn't bother me very much. Above all, Incredibles 2, like the original Incredibles, by the way, again, written and directed by the wonderful Brad Bird, is just a spectacular entertainment. It's too long, there's too much action and not enough of the clever dialogue that they do, but it's a really, really good movie, and as sort of mass market entertainments go, it's as good as anything I've seen this year. And that is my somewhat superheroized story this week, Joe.